Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 19th, 2005. This session, if you want to learn geology, you've got to know rocks. Don't take the rocks for granite. Presented by Donald Coberly in the Fireside Room, disc number COD 2005-01. Let's listen in.
And to reintroduce myself, my name is Don Coberly. I have passed out a handout set for you to keep if you would like. You don't have to. My feelings won't be hurt if you don't. What it says underneath there, Eller Hostel, Holden Village, September 2005, Donald M. Coberly, RPG, Senior Hydrogeologist. RPG means I'm a registered professional geologist. That's in the states of Oregon and Washington. Which means if I say something about geology and it turns out to be wrong, I can be sued. That's one of the ways I'm different than you. If you say something about geology and it's wrong, it's okay. The other thing is it says I'm a senior hydrogeologist. That's what it says on my business card. I always find that funny at work, and I think it's a ploy to get them, the clients that we work for, that they think I have been doing this a long time and I know what I'm talking about. And of all the times that being a senior hydrogeologist seems funny, this is the most funny, it seems. The format of my sessions will be a little bit different than what you did this morning. This is much more lecture-oriented because while I think we all have health stories and have been concerned about our health for a long time, while you guys have been frittering away your lives raising kids and doing business, I've been studying geology. So I have a lot more geology stories, I think. The session is going to run 40 minutes. We'll have a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and talk for another 40 minutes. We started a little late today, so the clock's already running. If we are in the middle of a conversation and I can stop it in less than 1 minute when my alarm goes off, we'll finish and then have our break. If we're in the middle of something, I'll stop it immediately so we can have our break because I think break time is the most important part of my session. This packet has notes and various things in it and pictures and will be useful today and tomorrow. And perhaps a little bit on Wednesday during the hike. And then you can take it home or take it back to your room and leave it Thursday and Friday. We'll sort of switch gears on Thursday and Friday, and this won't be as useful. So for the first 3 days, today, tomorrow, and Wednesday, we're going to talk about the fundamentals of geology. Very, 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 very basic geology. I have written there my thesis for this, and this is for geology in general. At its essence, geology is an observational science. It is based on observations of rocks, landforms, and the relationship in space of rock units to one another. Once observations have been made, it is possible to make interpretations or advance hypotheses about the geologic makeup and history of an area. Now, when I was rereading that this morning for the first time in a little while, I thought, So if that was your reaction to reading it, we feel the same way. The point is, what I see about geology, and when we get down to the goals, the one that I've written here, the second goal that I won't grab you by the ankles and beg you to get this, but geology is common sense. There's nothing magical or mystical about geology. And what I see in geology is we make observations. We go out and we look at rocks. We look at this rock right here and we say, black, flat, maybe laminated. It's got little layers in it. It's kind of dense. We write all these things down in our book. They're just simple observations that we make. To that, we add the sort of native common sense that we have and a little bit of first-level clues that I can provide you, and in the end, we're all geologists, right? I think a lot of people think of themselves as sort of amateur geologists. I don't know how many people know an amateur physicist, right? Because it's... unless you've got a scanning electron microscope in your basement, and maybe you do. But the stuff that we need to do geology is bloody everywhere, right? Let's go outside and we can go take a walk, and there's, unless you're in Nebraska, there's geology. Or Kansas, or anything kind of between the Rocky Mountains and the Appalachians is just kind of, you can do geology, it's just way harder. So that's the point that I see of this whole deal, is that geology is really common sense, and with a little head start and just native curiosity, we can learn a lot about geology. Today we're going to talk about rocks in a minute. Tomorrow we're going to talk about the basic concepts of geology. I think, and maybe this analogy will work for you, I work a lot in analogy and a lot in pictures and a lot in goofy, silly stories. And hopefully at the end of this silly story, you'll get the point that I'm trying to make. And I just lost my train of thought there. I think of rocks, a rock, as being sort of a word in this new language we're trying to learn. And when you think about it, I thought of this, a new idea since last time I was here. When a child is learning a new language, what is the first thing they learn? Objects. This is your nose. Ears, mouth, ears, mouth. Oh, they don't learn the connective phrases, and they don't learn the adjectives, and they don't learn anything else. They learn objects, right? These are the objects. These are the words of the new language of geology that we're going to learn. That's what we're going to talk about today. Tomorrow we're going to talk about some of the rules of grammar. How do you put the words together? When we go out and we take our hike on Wednesday, we'll see some rock layers. Now we need to start thinking about, well, okay, here we have a rock. We learned what it is. We learned what it might be able to tell us. Now we get a whole stack of them together. Now it's like we know the words dog and bark. Now we have to figure out, does that bark really relate to the bark of the dog, or is the next word we're going to learn tree, so the bark really relates to tree? We have to build up that way, and so that's tomorrow, is those sort of rules of grammar, or the laws of geology is what I call them. They're the basic concepts of geology. And then Wednesday we'll go out and we'll take a hike and we'll try to put into practice what we've learned these last, what we're going to learn today and tomorrow. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My goal is that after these sessions, that if you are interested, and I guess somewhere in there I talk about my list of assumptions. Let's do that first. My assumption is you have some interest in geology, or especially if I see you here tomorrow, I'll think you have some. and if I don't, that'll be fine. There, you know, some of us have seen the light and others just haven't quite. And that, again, as I talked about last night in the introduction, we could do a really bang-up job of studying the geology of this valley to a great deal of detail, which would be really helpful to you the next time you came back here. You could show off for your friends, and that would be great. But if you go someplace else that has some different kind of geology, you're kind of stuck, right? My thinking is you're going to spend most of the rest of your time doing elder hostels or other studies away from here, and therefore it's kind of more valuable for me to give you this sort of first level, here's the stuff that applies everywhere, so that next year when you're someplace else, you may not know all of the precise details of the geology, but you can get into it enough to have a little bit of fun doing that. And then wherever you go the next trip, or the trip after that, or the trip after that. So what I hope is, what we talk about over the next couple of days will sort of get you involved to a book like this called The Roadside Geology of Washington. There's a series of these. I've got Washington, Oregon, and Colorado right here. I've got Arizona back home. I have looked on one of the big bookstore chains, and there's like 30 of the states have this roadside geology series. I'm not paid by these people. I see those books as being a very good balance between the really cartoony geology that does us no good and the really complicated geology that does us no good because none of us can understand it. This is kind of in that middle ground, that if you have some interest in geology, and if you have read, you have to read a little bit to kind of get some of the jargon, And the way these books are set up is if you want to take Highway 97 going south from here down through the mountains to get back down to Ellensburg, you can look up on here and it will tell you the geology that you'll come across and where it will be and a little bit about it. So that if you want to pull over to the side of your the side of the road and safely get out of your car and go look at a rock outcrop, you can do that. So that, again, that roadside series of the state, roadside geology of whatever state, that's I see that as being a really good, not too hard, but still not so dumbed down that it doesn't do us any good at all. So that's my hope, is that if we do this and you get interested, next time you're on your field trip somewhere, you can pick up one of these books and you can go stop somewhere and look at what we're going to do on Wednesday. We'll go out and we'll see rock outcrops and look at rock, where it's sitting, how it's connected to the rest of the world, so we can look at what the geology of this area is. And that's the way I see the utility of what we're going to do for the next few days. The only other ideas I have about that is wherever you live, there's a community college. At that community college, there's probably an introductory geology class. It's probably being taught by someone who really loves geology and really loves teaching, or else they wouldn't be doing it at a community college because they don't get paid anything to do it. So that would be, if you wanted to spend 3 months taking a class, that would be a very good way to do it. The internet is a fabulous resource for geological information. The U.S. Geological Survey has a website that, and whatever you want to learn about, the type, if you're going to Nova Scotia next year, type in geology Nova Scotia in a search engine, and you're going to have more stuff than you ever thought was possible. The U.S. Geological Survey, there's one in Canada too that you can access their stuff through the website, and so there's tons of geologic information out there for you. Okay, I said in the thesis that geology is an observational science. I see it as being different than, say, physics or chemistry or math. Math is a calculation science or a computation science. Physics and chemistry are experimental sciences. You go do a chemistry experiment. Geology is an observational science. We go out and we do geology, or we look at geology. Vision, the sense of sight is probably the one we use the most, but it's not the only one we use. One of the things I do in my professional business is we need to know whether a soil sample that we take has clay in it or silt in it. I've written here, these are, when you look at little pieces of rock, they go in size from clay particles, the very smallest particles, through silt particles, which are a little bigger, sand, gravel, and boulder. These are all, I assume most of these are fairly common or known to you. If a soil has more clay in it than silt, that's an important thing for construction people to know. Well, one way, the precise way that you do that is you collect a big bunch of it and you take it to a lab and you run it through a bunch of sieves that have different size meshes to them, and now you can tell that. Well, we're not going to do that. We're going to go out, or when you first go to the field to do geology, one of the things you do is you'll get some of this stuff in your fingers and use some water, or if you don't have any water, you spit on it and you make kind of a mud, and both by knowing the texture of it, the clay particles are real buttery and real smooth. So if your little ball of mud is really smooth between your fingers, you know it's mostly clay. If it's a little bit gritty, you know there's some silt in it. So we would, if we were doing more serious geology, we would write that in our field book. The same thing you can do is you can hear, you can use your sense of hearing to, oh, it sounds a little bit scritchy. That's a real technical term. It sounds gritty as you have some sound to it. If you would take some butter between your fingers and put it up to your ear, you wouldn't hear anything, right? Because it's real smooth. So you can use these other senses that you have. What else? Vision, hearing. Oh, smell. When rocks have sulfur in them, and you pound on them with a hammer, it's like the old toy gun caps, but some of us some our mom wouldn't let us use when we were growing up. But some of you might have been able to do that. So you get that powder, that sulfury smell. The same thing up here on the tailings piles behind us, and we'll look at this on Friday. When you dig down into those tailings and get to the tailings that haven't been sort of oxidized, rusted out, you get that same sort of smell. And I know what that is. I don't need to take a sample and take it back to the lab to know there's sulfur in it. I can tell that simply by smelling it. The last thing is your sense of taste. It's not so much your sense of taste as it is your sense of texture. Rock salt, if you find a sample that's cubic, looks like a dice, and it's clear, and you think it might be halite, NaCl, you could lick it, and if it's salty, then you would know that it was rock salt. I don't really suggest doing that. By the same token that you're doing this clay silt thing with your fingers, another way to do, an even more sensitive way to do that, is to take a little bit of it and put it in your mouth. Now, you don't do this at hazardous waste sites, but you can do it here. And when you take that and you rub it on the back of your upper teeth, if it's still real smooth and buttery, now you know that it's clay material. And if it's kind of gritty, now you know there's silt in it. So we can use all our senses when we're out doing geology. When we look at the sample, we'll use predominantly the sense of sight. We'll look at things and compare and contrast them. But again, my geology is an observational science. Observation, common sense, a little bit of basic geology, and you can go understand a lot of stuff. Okay. If I've told you there are some reasons that you might want to study geology. Maybe you believe me, maybe you don't. That second page of your book comes from a world-renowned expert on all things, Ann Landers. Are geologists different? Spouses have stories. Dear Ann Landers, this letter, my first ever to a columnist, was sparked by your column about the geologist's wife who asked, are all geologists the very embodiment of all the virtues and qualities that are universally admired in humankind? Have they alone, of all the professions, achieved a state of grace far beyond that ever speculated by history's most hopeful philosophers and theologians? The answer is absolutely. Now, some of us have known that for a long time. You'll notice there's nothing in here about doctors. You can read all of the benefits that might accrue to you by studying geology. I can't say that all of these will come to you. Cliff was here for only 5 days learning geology last year. What I understand is he's nicer to kids than he used to be. Dogs like him better.
I can find the rock stick I can throw at him.
The next page is a cartoon that you can read at your leisure. Then we move on to the page that says rocks. That's what we were supposed to start talking about 20 minutes ago. There are three major categories of rocks. That's all you need to know. If you can keep those three, that's the basic widest differentiation. It's like in trees. You got conifers and you got deciduous trees, right? That's the first place where the world of trees breaks apart. In geology, it's three different kinds: sedimentary, igneous, and metamorphic. We'll talk about each of those for as much as time will allow today. In sedimentary, and once you start, again, as this hierarchy sort of devolves, in trees, it's trees, and then deciduous and ones with needles, conifers, and maybe cactus, I don't know. Then you go down to the next level, and your conifers split into some other lower level so that now we can figure out which every little section, which every kind of tree fits in. The same thing happens in rocks, but it's sedimentary, igneous, and metamorphic at the first level. We go down one level in the sedimentary rocks. Those get split up into clastic, C-L-A-S-T. A clast is a fragment or a piece of rock. That's a good crossword puzzle word that may stump you sometimes. Clastic rocks, and those rocks are sediment that is moved by a fluid. Hard grains that are moved by a fluid. You can think about sediment in wine, if you drink really good wine. You can think of sediment in your toilet tank that gets in there sometimes, right? It's the little grains and stuff, and then it gets moved by a fluid. That sediment gets lithified, gets turned to rock, and now we have a sedimentary rock. That fluid we normally almost always think of as being water. There are other things we can think of. We can think of air, sand dunes, right? If that sand dune, what is it that transports the sand grains? It's the wind. You don't think of water transporting sand dunes. And that rock could be lithified then. Stuff gets laid down on top of it. It gets turned to stone. And the fluid that has moved that sediment was air. The other fluid that we think about is ice, which is still water, but it's frozen water. Liquid water is limited into how big a material it can move by how much of it there is. Ice, glaciers, rocks fall onto the ice, they get incorporated into the ice, they get moved down the valley and they get dumped out. That ice can transport very large boulders because of the density and the viscosity of the fluid, right? So those are we think of fluids as being water and air. Subdivide water into either liquid water or ice. That's the transporting thing. We'll also talk about chemical sedimentary rocks real briefly. The rock name of sedimentary rocks is based on that grain size. So that if you have clay-sized particles and you turn it into a rock, you call it a clay stone. Silt-sized particles turned into a rock is a silt stone. Sandstone, everybody, that's a common enough term that everybody knows that term, right? Sandstone. Gravel stone and boulder stone are colloquial geologic terms. We call them conglomerates, right? A whole bunch of stuff put together. So, again, this all seems fairly straightforward to me. Sedimentary rock, sediment is grains moved by a fluid, gets turned into a rock. We'll talk about igneous and metamorphic rocks a little bit more. Let's focus on sedimentary rocks right now for the moment. Whenever there's a question, feel free to ask me that. That doesn't apply just in here. That applies wherever you see me in the village. There are two times that doesn't apply. One is while I'm washing dishes, which will be Friday night at 4:30. You can't ask me that then. And secondly is during the worship service. You can ask me just before or just after, but if you try to talk to me during the service, then somebody's going to get mad at both of us. Any other time you see me, that's a good time to ask me the question, okay? If while we're talking here in session and we get into something that just the two of us want to talk about, I'll call a timeout and then we can do that over coffee later, and I'd be glad to do that. Okay, sedimentary rocks. If someone comes to you and says, I'm holding a rock behind my back, guess what kind of rock it is? Guess sedimentary. The odds are with you. 70% of the rocks that we can see at the surface here and that we can get our hands on are sedimentary rocks. So that's why you should go with that as a first guess. Now, in this little part of the world that we're in right now, that's not so true, and there are other places where it's not so. You know, standing on Mount St. Helens, you would guess most of that's volcanic because it's a volcano. But in most cases, if you guess sedimentary rock, that's the best guess. That's the first guess you should make. How do we tell a sedimentary rock from other kinds of rocks? What you all have in your hand right now is an igneous rock. And I've had passed that out to you sort of for comparison purposes as we're talking. A sedimentary rock, what you will see, the best way to look at or think of a sedimentary rock is go to your local Lowe's or Home Depot and buy a sheet of sandpaper and go home and get out your magnifying glass, which is what these things are. This is a geologist's hand lens, which is just simply a fancy term for a magnifying glass. And look at your piece of sandpaper. And what you will see is individual grains of sand or something that have been glued to this piece of paper. Well, just think about a sandstone as being the grains not being glued to a piece of paper, but glued to each other. Okay? And so when you, I will pass around a piece of sandstone that you can look at. I have a couple of pieces we can look at, and a magnifying glass. And what you will notice when you look at these sort of comparatively is that the sandstone, you will see these grains, and in some cases they touch each other, and in some cases there's cement in between them that is holding them together. But you will see all of these specific particular grains. If you look at the same time, or just after that, look at your igneous rock, which has solidified or cooled from the melted state, the molten state, you may see these different grains. In this case, they're crystals, and they may have some shape to them, but they will sort of completely interlock, and you won't see these open spaces in between, or spaces where you see the edges of something with some cement between them. Now, that's a real simplistic sort of way of looking at it, but that's what we have time for if we're going to learn all of geology in 3 days. So that's when the sedimentary rock gets very fine grain, in some cases it gets really hard to tell. We're looking at sort of more basic stuff and trying to give you as much information so you can be 95% away along as quickly as possible. So that's the way to try to tell those, and in some cases, particularly if it's a larger grained rock, you'll be able to tell that. One of the things about geology that I like very much is by holding a rock in your hands, once you've gone out, when we go out on Wednesday, we'll go to an outcrop, and we know that there's a big mass of rock there that is attached to the rest of the world. Or if we would go to the Grand Canyon and we would hike down in it and we'd bang a piece of the rock off and then we would hold it in our hand, we have information about the history, the geology of that place at some point way into the past. We don't know how far into the past it was, millions of years, billions of years, but we can glean some information from that rock that tells us something. I will have to work with Cliff to try and think of an analogy to medicine. Perhaps when he gets a test result back, all he sees is a bunch of numbers, and from that he can go, oh, or, oh, right? He can, just by having that thing, he can tell some more information. In this case, that's what we're learning from these rocks, that it tells us something more about what the geologic history of that area was. At the bottom of that page of your notes, it says, three things to infer from sediment or clastic sedimentary rocks. One is the source area geology. Two is the distance to the source area, either near or far. If we look at a rock and we make some sort of assumptions about it or investigate it a little farther, we could say, oh, well, the source may be nearby. Or, wow, we're way away from the source. I don't mean to say that by looking at a sedimentary rock that you can say, well, it's 42.96 miles back to the source. We don't have that degree of precision, but we can kind of differentiate near or far. And the third thing to think about, or that we'll talk about, is the energy and the consistency of the environment of deposition. What that means is the sediment was deposited somewhere. It got dropped out of the fluid so that we can see it. If it was still in the fluid, we wouldn't be able to see it anymore because it's out in the ocean somewhere or being moved down a river right now. That environment of deposition, this is where the rock got deposited. Did it get deposited on a beach? Did it get deposited in a sand dune? Did it get deposited out in the middle of the ocean? That's the kind of thing that we're going to be able, we'll start to be able to talk about. So I something on the next page about expanding the source area geology. How do we discover the geology of Upper Railroad Creek? We are in this valley. Railroad Creek runs down the valley. This way's north. Here's the lake down here. Here's Railroad Creek. It actually turns and goes up, or turns to the south. Big Creek kind of comes in here. Holden Creek comes in here. And all around us are big mountains. Martin Ridge and North Star and Bonanza and Copper and Dumbbell and Buckskin. And we're right here. This is us. That's Dr. Cliff. So here's the, imagine that back in 1997 when I first came here as part of the big study, my boss had come to me and my buddy Jamie and said, I want you guys to tell me the geology of all of this up here. And my friend Jamie, who's 10 years younger than me and who hikes and cross-country skis and downhill skis and whatever, and has got a backpack, you know, the Cadillac of backpacks, he would go, yes! Because he knew for the next 2 weeks he could get and go hiking and climbing and have his rock hammer and pounding rocks and putting them in bags, and he would think, this is so cool. And I'd think, well, I can do that too. And so Jamie would load up all his tent, all his gear, and all his cold meals and all of that stuff, and he'd head out. And 2 weeks later he'd come back and he'd be bloody and bruised and tired and wet, and he'd smell bad, and he'd have been eating cold food the whole time, and he'd be really happy. And he'd have a backpack full of rocks, and he'd say, all right, here's the stuff. Now what I would do, because what I like rather than all that hiking foolishness is to play golf and drink coffee with Lutherans. I'd go down to the bridge here and go to the other side and jump down in the river and start, and I'd probably take a hammer with me and break up some of the pieces of rock and start looking. And I'd pick out a bunch of pieces and I'd try to do it a little bit systematically, and then when the bell rang, I'd come back and have coffee while he's out eating cold stuff and getting rained on. And I'd go back and do some more work, and at the end of 2 weeks, when he came back, we'd each have a pile of rocks. And I'd have slept in a bed every night. And you know, that's just two ways of going about it. I would let the force of gravity and the force of fluid mechanics be my friends. Let gravity bring the rocks down into the stream. Let the stream bring them down, and I'll just sit here and wait for it. The point of, again, the first of the many goofy stories is that sediment, what is sediment right now, that in time may become lithified and turned into rock, tells us about what the geology is up there. It's the only way. How do you get rocks in that stream right there? Well, they've got to come kind of from this bowl, right? There are a couple other, and now here, we can think about this. As it turns out, when I have my big pile of rocks and Jamie dumps out his backpack and we start looking at the rocks, we should find the same thing, right? Makes common sense. Only that isn't what happens. I got a couple of rocks in my piles that he hasn't found. Now, you can argue that, well, he got lazy and he skipped one of the places. That's not going to happen. Conceptually, just thinking, I have some stuff that he doesn't. Why should that be the case? And anybody have any first ideas about why that might be?
The age of the rock?
I don't think that applies precisely in this case. What would happen if all of this area, when it was originally laid down, was laid down in just horizontal layers, and you had sandstone up at the top and siltstone next to it and something, and now those mountains have been raised up and they start to erode down? What would happen if all of the rocks around here at the tops of the mountains had been eroded away? There's a rock unit that was originally laid down that isn't there anymore. Isn't there anymore up in the mountains, but it's still here. If you go to Colorado, go to near Denver, Colorado, Golden, the Red Rocks Amphitheater, where you can go see music, There are a whole bunch, or the Flatirons in Boulder, or the Garden of the Gods in Colorado Springs. There are these big sheets of rock that are stood up on end, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. And those rocks are conglomerates, so they have pebbles in them. And by looking at those pebbles, we can make some guess as to what the Rocky Mountain, the last version of the Rocky Mountains, was before this one, even though they've been gone for 200 million years. You can think about for the next 10 minutes the other way that I may have rocks in my sediment that Jamie doesn't in his backpack, and we'll go from there. 10 minutes. Well, you know, if you want people to know your name as you're leaving, you kind of should turn this over so that they can...
Oh, it's in the back now?
Well, yeah, but now it's facing backwards, so people go, oh, well, that was Virginia.
It was in front. I don't know how it got turned around.
And we got old newspapers.
I guess the one about Arizona.
Well, one of the nice things about Arizona is you can bloody see the geology. Right?
There's the story about a guy from Texas that said, and somebody said, don't you love the scenery around here? And he said, well, I don't know, you can't see it. It's all covered in these damn trees.
That's, well, where I got my bachelor's degree in geology on the north coast of California, doing geology is horrible just because you got stinking redwoods on top of it and soil, you know, 20 feet thick. And
right.
I guess from that day, but
Grand Canyon is very interesting geologically speaking.
Oh, absolutely. And again, the great thing about that is you can see every little bit of it. I after moving, you know, getting my degree and then working offshore, I worked offshore for 3 years, and then you're looking at drill cuttings, so you're looking at pieces of rock about this big. I finally moved back to Colorado to start grad school and went,
huge rock.
Holy, you can see it, and it's big.
Yeah, my son is a geophysicist.
That's right, you had mentioned that. Where does he work?
He's from the Skelly River in Aramco.
Okay.
Worked in Texas mostly. Although the last, he started at Phillips.
Uh-huh.
I think that is true. I think that quit. You know, they laid off about 10 players before they finally got the answer, and they had that unwelcome takeover effort.
Right.
And he was working for them recently when Conoco, was it? And they joined.
Yes.
They moved his division down to Houston, and his wife really can't stand really hot weather, and so he tried for Aramco. They wanted to know why he wanted to move there, and he said, well, I really think it's safer there than it is in Houston. This was before the latest defugal started over there. But they don't seem to feel that they're in any danger any more than you are just normally.
As we go from Seattle to Yakima, and we saw these huge mountains, were they all basalt columns? We saw, to me it was so interesting because there were so many that were the vertical lines.
When you see that columnar stuff, six-sided stuff, it's almost always basalt.
Okay, because we were just driving.
Sure. I've got some. Yeah, if you driving up the Heavier than these other samples. Yes. But, and so that makes me think that the rock material that's in there is probably pretty dense. That's why it looks like it. We call it arm waving. All right. You thought Cliff had a bad bedside manner? Try mine.
John?
Yes, sir.
You said that there are only three kinds of stones. But what about gallstones and kidney stones?
I'm thinking you and I together can publish a paper. Sorry?
They must be clastic.
They're, let's see, solid material moved by a fluid. I don't think I want to get into that. Okay.
It's cute.
All right, the other, anybody, while they were out getting a cup of coffee and having a drink, think of another way that we might get rock into this valley that I might get in my sediment that Jamie wouldn't see in the wall rocks as he was
looking. Somebody could bring it in.
Sorry?
Somebody could bring it in.
Virginia Big has the same devious mind I do. One of the ways that this might happen is because I was in Indonesia three times in the 90s and collected some rocks there, if I were a funny guy, I might just bring a couple of them up here and dump them out of my bag. So that 30 years from now, when some graduate student is up here doing their master's, they're like, if they're as devious as I, he'd put it in his pack and never tell anybody about it. So, Bertha, go ahead.
How about from a volcanic explosion 40 or 50 miles away?
That's a possibility that I hadn't thought of yet. That's another one of the lists that we would need to write down. Again, sure. The bigger the rock, the closer the volcano would have to be. Mm-hmm. But that's a...
I'm going to guess water.
Okay.
The stream that's eroded down to another layer that he didn't get to.
Wow.
Erosion.
Next year when I claim that, I'm going to say it was my idea. I hadn't thought of that.
Glaciers drop them, too.
Glaciers drop them.
All the mining that's taken place around here.
All, man, this is like five answers I've never thought of before. Another idea. As it turns out, the glacier is in this case the source. There are some rocks that were found here that nobody could figure out where they sort of belonged back to until somebody up in British Columbia said, oh yeah, those are mine. That the glacier had come through and had come over the pass here and deposited that, you know, back whatever it was, 18, 20,000 years ago and farther back into the past, the glacier had overrun. We sort of think of this as being a permanent feature, and it's not that way at all. So, but those other ideas, there were three or four other ideas in here that, like I said, next year I'm going to claim as mine. Yeah. They were that good. Okay, so source area geology, we've talked about that, and how you might find what we see here might help us figure out what's back up there. And when you do a geochemical exploration for finding new minerals, that's one of the first ways that you go about doing it in sort of the reconnaissance mode, is drop somebody in with a helicopter at Railroad Creek, if this is in Indonesia. This is precisely how they found the mine that I worked on there, is How do you explore 100,000 square miles to find out, if Jamie were to do it, he'd be really old before he got back. In this case, you drop somebody in with a helicopter at each of these sort of stream tributary branches, and you take a bunch of sample, and you take it back to the lab, and you grind it up, and you see if there's any gold in it. And if there's not, you check it off, nope, and you move on. So, second thing, on that page, my page 204, distance to the source area. And I say, think of the environment as a rock tumbler. All of geology comes down to two forces. Mountains are built generally by the heat that is contained in the earth, recycling rocks and pushing up mountains. Everything else is related to erosion. The higher the mountains get up, the more easily they're eroded. So there's this entire balance, or this ongoing balance, going on for 4.5 billion years now, of mountains being built up by internal geologic forces and mountains being torn down by erosion. Water, wind, ice, things like that. I think of the environment as the biggest rock tumbler you've ever seen. Let's do another thought experiment, what Einstein called thought experiments, what everybody else calls make-believe. What would happen if right now we heard this big rumbling noise and a bunch of material came off of Copper Peak and dumped down into a little spot right at the base of it? And we were able to go up there with a big dump truck and load that stuff out, and we'd look at it. And what kind of material would we find? We would find everything from sand grains that came down to Volkswagens that came down, right? All this stuff comes down at once, boom, sits there. We hear the noise, here's this big landslide, whatever. If you look at a landslide deposits, every kind of rock is there that was up in the mountains. Every size is there, from sand to Volkswagen. When the particles fall, since they fall so quickly, it's all angular stuff. There's not much chance for the stuff to get, the corners to get rounded off. That all falls there. We go, we put our dump truck on the helicopter, we take it up there, we load a whole bunch, we got a whole dump truck here. And then somewhere back over there, we have the biggest rock tumbler anybody's ever seen. It's industrial strength, it's nuclear powered, it's gonna run forever. We shovel all of this stuff into the rock tumbler, and we turn it on, and we go away. And we come back here next year, and we go over there and turn it off for a minute. We fork a whole bunch of it out, and we look at it. And then we turn it back on, and we go away. And we come back 10 years from here, and we do the same thing. What we see in each of our little pans is not going to be the same. What we saw on the day that it fell was all sizes, all shapes, all angular, all rock types. Once that stuff gets into the rock tumbler, what happens?
It's more uniform.
Big pieces bash into other big pieces and break them in two, or into other fragments. The smaller pieces probably sort of weasel between the big pieces so they don't get busted up so much. So the grain sizes, the size of the pieces, gets more uniform. What else happens? Well, why do you put rocks in a rock tumbler in the first place? Polish them up, smooth them up, round them up. So that's the second thing that will happen. They'll become rounder. The third thing that will happen, particularly if we put some water in there, is there will be some chemical reactions go on so that the less resistant material will go into solution and we'll no longer see it as a solid piece. It'll be in the solution, and if we would take the solution out and test it, we would still see that calcium that used to be in one of these fragments is now in the water. So, taking that thought picture and taking it back into the real world, when you see something and it's close to its original source area, it will have those characteristics. All grain size, all fragment sizes, or most fragment sizes there. It'll all be really angular. All sizes, all angular, all materials present. Take it down to the other end, now take it into the real world, and we've transported it some great distance, and through the the rocks are more uniform in Railroad Creek now than the stuff at the top of the avalanche chute is, because it's starting to be tumbled down, and now it gets into the lake. And though even the grain size is there, some stuff has been left behind, so all of that stuff that gets down there is usually or is reasonably the same grain size. So if we took a piece, if we could find two pieces of rock and have one that was angular, all different sizes, round, all the same sizes, our first guess would be this is pretty close to where we were. This is close to the source area, and this is pretty far from the source area. Anything magical about that? Seems really commonsensical to me, common sense to me.
And that turns to mud eventually?
If it were to spend more time in the rock tumbler, if we would come back after 100 years, what would be left in the rock tumbler would probably be pretty much all the same stuff. And it may get so beaten up that it's down to mud size. All right, the third thing that I talk about is the energy and consistency of the environment of deposition. Sediment at the base of the avalanche chute versus railroad creek versus a beach. If somehow after that big rock fall happened, that stuff was never transported and this area were submerged somehow through geologic processes and material got laid down on top of it, and that material were lithified, were turned to stone, we would see all of those characteristics that we just talked about. When we think about, and so where is it that these sediments get deposited? Get deposited in the creek, get deposited in the ocean. Of the places that I think of on the planet that are the most regular as far as the geologic perspective goes, I think of a beach. The beach has been doing the same thing every day for the last billion years. Water comes in, water goes out. Water comes in, water goes out. 5,000 times a day, 2 billion years, that's a lot of So, if you go to Wyoming, on the eastern side of Wyoming, that area, everything between the Rocky Mountains and the Appalachians has been reasonably quiet for much of geologic history. All of the stuff that's happening on the continents happens kind of on the edges as more stuff bashes into it, and we'll talk more about that through the week. But everything between the Rockies and the Appalachians, even though the Rockies have come up and been eroded down a couple of times, all of that internal stuff has been really quiet, shallow seas. And so the beach has always been, or for long periods of time, was in Wyoming. And if you go to certain places in Wyoming, what you will find is material like what we see in these jars. And this material gets mined and screened very minimally, and now what you're left with is what's in these jars. It's all the same size, it's all the same shape, rounded essentially, and it's all the same material, quartz, because quartz is really resistant. Everything else is gone. So that helps tell us, if we would go someplace and we would see that, we would say, oh, we know that that environment has been the same for a long period of time, and it's been reasonably of the same energy. Again, our avalanche chute, the energy that's there, it's really energetic, right? Boom, and then avalanche. One time, short duration, high energy. This stuff is at the other end of the spectrum. Low energy, day after day, year after year, millennium after millennium. Make sense? In geologic terms, we call those, in the last section, hopefully you were reading as I was blathering, grain sizes become more equal. Sorting is the geologic term we use for that. And skip ahead through the end of the notes, and here is a card, here is a handout that shows sort of the geologic way that we talk about grain sizes. You'll see the smaller card is the actual scale. And so when I was working offshore, when we saw sand grains of a certain size, we would call those a medium sand. And oh, all of the other geologists would go, he's talking about a medium sand, I know what size that is. I blew that card up a little bit to show you these ideas of sorting and angularity. We talked about them sort of conceptually. Well sorted means it's all the same stuff. Poorly sorted means everything is there. Angular means it's sharp edges. Rounded means it's rounded. So those are the geologic sort of technical terms for those ideas that we've been talking about. The next page after that is the quiz. And the quiz is fairly simple. Here is a picture, color picture. This is the one I'm talking about right here with the blue background. And what this is, as a matter of fact, is a concrete wall that someone had poured and then cut a hole through. And when I was there at this site doing some work, I looked over and went, man, that's going to be really useful to me in elder hostel sessions. And so the point of this is, everyone's already passed the quiz. Some of you have done actually very well. Let's use our ideas of observation. First thing, if we were confronted with this out when we go hiking on Wednesday, the first thing we would do would be look at it and say, okay, what do we see? I will tell you right now that this is a sedimentary rock called concrete. It was deposited as a fluid and then lithified. And so what can we tell? Lots of different materials there or all the same? Lots of different stuff. Angular or rounded? Mostly rounded. There's some sort of what on our card we would read as being subangular. What's the difference in the grain sizes that are present? I mean, the biggest thing we see here is probably the size of a quarter, and it goes down from there. And we can't, because of the resolution of the picture, we can't see how small it gets. So we're not in the avalanche chute because there's no Volkswagens in here. And we're not at the beach because there's a lot of different grain sizes here. But again, just in the observation mode, here are the things we should be thinking about. And I guess I wrote a little list, perhaps, in those notes. Have we covered each of those little topics? Angularity, sorting, one rock type versus many rock types. Just based on what we can see due to the different colors, that's not really the best way to do it, but it's what we have for the moment. There's different rock types here. Size of the rock particles. Small to quarter size, but nothing bigger than that. Range of size fragments present, that's the sorting, and the angularity of the fragments. So for right now, what we would do, if we were looking at this the first day, we would just write all of these things down, we'd take a digital photo of it, we'd start to think, well, kind of energetic, but not real energetic, right? We're not in the avalanche chute, and we're not at the beach. We're somewhere in between that. And of course, we don't need to do that because this is a man-made thing that we put together, but we would go through that same sort of exercise. The next picture, however, is not man-made and is actual geology. And there is a quarter in the picture, kind of down lower middle, to give scale, to show you what size a quarter is. And now, here we are in the real world, and we would go through precisely the same ideas. What's the biggest rock size present? Or what's the range of sizes present? Well, there's stuff there that's smaller than we can see, and there's a thing up here in the corner that's 50 quarters wide, right? Pretty big, boulder. Angular or rounded? Certainly more angular generally than the concrete wall. More variety in grain size present, more angularity. We could, if we wanted to, we could sort of look at this, and if we're going to be real serious, we could count the number of what we think to be each of these different. There's the kind of reddish-gray rock, and we may say, oh, that's, let's see, there's 35% reddish-gray rock in here and 22% gray, something like that. We could do that if we wanted to. There's no need to do it right now. The point here is just looking and comparing and contrasting these two. This is a more energetic system, a real system, than the sort of make-believe system that generated the concrete wall, right? Does that make sense?
Is that an aspen there, the little?
No, that's a quarter.
Quarter.
That little, that round white thing? That's what?
That's a quarter.
Sunshine. Oh, it's a quarter?
Yeah.
A quarter.
A quarter that I set there because everybody knows how big a quarter is.
What's like an aspirin?
Okay.
Take it down below. Are you talking about right?
A little one.
All right. Yeah,
but
so that's, we've covered sedimentary rock. We got 20 minutes left to cover two-thirds of the entire rock set on the planet. Oh my gosh. Igneous rocks. The next main category of rocks. Igneous rocks. Igneous comes from the same root, I imagine, as ignite. Has something to do with fire. What other words? Ignition. Igneous rocks are rocks that have solidified. They were molten at one point and have now solidified. The center of the Earth, or the central portion of the Earth, is much hotter than the surface of the Earth. It's the same way that when you take a baked potato out of the microwave, the center of the potato is much hotter than the edges of the potato, once you've let it cool off a little bit, because the outside cools because it's in contact with the air. So as we go down from the surface here, where we're standing on hard rock, we go through sort of molten, viscous rock to molten rock to right at the core. It's solidified again, even though it's way hotter than it should be to melt. It's just there's so much rock sitting on top of it. So there is a zone in the middle portion of the planet where the rock is molten. As it gets closer to the surface, it gets cooler and the rock cools. The two main categories, again, now we've branched down one more tree or one more level in our tree of sedimentary, igneous, metamorphic. We drop down. Within the igneous rocks, there are two main types, extrusive, and you can think of something being extruded, toothpaste being extruded from a tube, and intrusive. Let's leave that aside for a moment. Extrusive stuff gets extruded at the surface. The surface is cold, or relatively cold. Intrusive rocks are ones that have come up from the molten state and have solidified very slowly and at some depth. Miles deep. Think of Yosemite. The granites that we see at Yosemite now cooled and solidified at 2 or 3 or 4 miles below the current surface. And over time, as part of the mountain range, the Sierra Nevada, have been raised up. And so there has been 2 or 3 or 4 miles of erosion to finally expose what we can go see and take pictures of and climb right now. The thing to think about here is the thought experiment. If we had a solution that we poured some chemical in, and since we had the solution hot, we could super saturate it. We could put more chemical in the water than the water should hold because it's boiling and there's enough energy to keep that stuff in solution. And we take 3 pans. We've got our stuff boiling, and we decide what we're going to do with 1 pan of this stuff is turn the heat off and run it up and put it in the freezer. And the 2nd pan, we're just going to turn the heat off and we're going to let it sit there and cool at its own rate. And the 3rd pan, that's right now at 100 degrees centigrade, we're going to turn down to 99 degrees centigrade. And we'll come back a week later and turn it down to 98. Come back a week later, 97, 96. At a degree, so like 2 years from now, we finally have that thing turned off. And then at some point, we would look in the pans and see what we had. What would we have? In the one that we threw in the freezer immediately, it had cooled so rapidly that you wouldn't form any crystals. The one that we let sort of cool on its own, the crystals might form, but they wouldn't be very big. And the one that we let cool very, very slowly, we would see 2 or 3 or 4 really big crystals, just because we've allowed it to cool slowly. So the crystal size that you see in the igneous rock gives you a first guess as to did this cool rapidly or did this cool slowly. If you go to Hawaii, to one of the volcanoes, that exploded yesterday and the stuff's cool today, in geologic time, that's no time at all. One day cooling, right? It was molten yesterday, cold, rock today, no crystals. So you take your hand lens and you look at it as hard as you can, and then you get a bigger, better hand lens, and you still look and you still can't see any crystals. That's because there aren't any there. It cooled too quickly. Now you go to Yosemite, and you don't even need a hand lens. You can point out the crystals. You can, you know, there's stuff there that's got crystals that are, you know, thumbnail size pieces that has to have cooled slowly. Again, we think about, and where on the planet can things cool slowly? It has to be down deep somewhere. There's no way that you can grow crystals like that at the surface in the geologic environment. Go ahead.
Would that be basaltic columns that we see exposed?
Yes.
Would they?
Yes. And if you would, and particularly driving up the Columbia River Gorge and in places in Washington, you will see this rock called basalt, which is an extrusive igneous rock. It gets pooped out at the surface and flows and then cools. And that may happen over a day or a week, but again, in geologic terms, that's instantaneously. So when you go to look for, get one of these books and you say you're gonna go look at basalt and you take your hand lens out, and there's blood. You can't see anything because the crystals are usually so small. Whereas, now if you go to Yosemite, you can see those and you can see them bigger. Now, the other alternative that I think I bring up in there is what happens if you see a rock that has a few big crystals in it, but everything else is really small. Slow cooling to develop those big crystals, and then fast cooling to not allow anything else to form. So that rock may have formed, had a history where it moved slowly to some depth, and then there's a fault that happens, and now there's this path to the surface, and because of the pressure, that stuff comes up to the surface very rapidly, and now you may see this rock that has a few big crystals in it, but mostly small crystals. Make sense? I have one piece, the rock that you have is igneous, has solidified from a melt, has what I think of as being sort of intermediate-sized grains or crystals in it. So neither cooled overnight or cooled over millions of years. If we would look into our igneous rocks further, and we had more time to do it, we could identify some of the minerals that are present either through their color or through the crystal shape that they grow into. And now we know, by doing a bunch more study, we could figure out, oh, that's a crystal of biotite, or that's a grain of amphibole. And by thinking, there's the chemistry of that, we could learn more about the chemistry of the rock. We don't have the time to do that. If you want to do that, you can take an entire semester course on how to do that. But I have another piece of igneous rock right here that I'll pass around with the hand lens. And again, you can do the sort of compare and contrast idea. Crystals are bigger in this than in the one that you've got. It's probably cooled more slowly. There are different, again, color is not a really good indicator, but in this case, it's what we have to work with. There are different colors here there that may suggest something different in the chemistry of the rock itself. Any questions about igneous rocks? We're going to skip by these other sidelines for right now, and we can talk about those at your leisure as we're having a cup of tea later. Go ahead.
Is a diamond an igneous rock?
Yes. Formed very deep in the earth under very high pressure, and then it would be that big crystals, a few big crystals in mostly small crystals. That's called a pegmatite. That's the geologist jargon for it. And again, it indicates slow cooling, slow cooling, slow cooling, boom, fast cooling. And that's precisely the way diamonds form. And a diamond is really not stable. The diamond forms so deep and at such great pressure that it's really unstable at the Earth's surface, geologically speaking. We think of it as being very stable, but over a million years, diamonds will, at the surface, will degenerate. They'll become carbon. So yes, it's an igneous rock.
What besides time creates crystals? What?
It's the same way that it would do in our pan. It's the chemistry, it's the underlying chemistry of the material that's in that molten state. If it's all silica, SiO2, so silicon and oxygen, you'll get quartz crystals, those six-sided clear crystals. So that, and again, I think it's really interesting, but it's a little bit subtle or not of interest to the wide population about how the underlying chemistry impacts the crystals that you see. If the melt that you have, if the only stuff you have in your ice cream churn is eggs and vanilla and sugar, or whatever, is there anything else that goes in vanilla ice cream?
Milk.
That's milk. You're going to get vanilla ice cream. If you put other stuff in there, now you're going to get cherry or fudge ripple or whatever. If what's in the melted rock, that thing has a chemistry of its own, and depending on what's in there, as that cools, there are only a certain number of things that can come out of it. You can't get a diamond, carbon, in a melt that doesn't have any carbon in it, right? It just simply, there's no material for that, no chemicals for that to form out of. So that's the other thing. That's why there's a difference in color, particularly between these two. The one will, they have different chemistries, the melt that they started from. Go ahead.
There are also people named after Ignis rocks. I have an Italian uncle, Ignazio, and then there's Ignace, and Saint Ignatius, I think.
I think Uncle Ignazio is because he was really volatile. I could be wrong about that. Okay, the third rock type that we can talk about in 7.5 minutes, because that's all we have left, is metamorphic rocks. And the term metamorphism that I think of is precisely the same term metamorphism I think you may think of. You think of a caterpillar changing into a butterfly as being a metamorphosis, a change. When I think of metamorphic rocks, the definition of a metamorphic rock is a rock that has been changed. How can we change a rock at the Earth's surface or near the Earth's surface? The physical properties, the world, the only things that are really different here at the surface to, say, a couple miles below the surface are the pressure. There's nothing sitting on a rock right now other than us when we walk on it. Whereas if you're 2 miles deep, the rock down there has 2 miles of rock sitting on top of it. Squash pretty hard. Pressure and then temperature. As I said, as you get closer to the center of the Earth, it gets hotter. If anybody's been down in a mine or seen the Discovery Channel stuff about the diamond mines in South Africa that are 2 miles deep, they're 10 degrees hotter down there simply because they're closer to the center of the Earth. They're closer to the center of the baked potato that's still hot in the middle. So when I think about what happens to a rock, a very fine-grained sedimentary rock that gets deposited out in the ocean is called a shale. So that if you have a piece of shale in your hand, if we find a piece of shale out here, what should we think about that? We've described it, we've decided it's a shale. Where does shale get deposited? Bottom of the ocean. If we find this rock out there, we have to say, all right, at some time in the past, this little piece of turf that we're standing on right now is at the bottom of the ocean. If you take some of that shale, and now you squish on it really hard, you get a thing called slate, which is reasonably the same stuff. It's thin layers of mud that have been laid down year after year after year after year after year, only this stuff has only had a little bit sitting on top of it. This stuff has had miles of other material sitting on top of it, and it's compressed it down, and so it's denser. So this you skip in the creek, and this you make pool tables out of. That shale to or slate shale to slate idea is simply a compression. And so the only pressure that we see is more weight being put on top. What happens if we not only put some weight on top, but we push on something on the side, which is what happens in these mountain building ideas? One of the, it may tip up, but one of the things that happens if it can't do that, the rock will begin to reform. The minerals will start to segregate because thermodynamically it's a lower state.